Those cases is Anthony Deshaun Bethel against the Commonwealth. Is it Ms. Crossett?
On behalf of the appellate, Your Honor, Justin Crossett.
And Mr. Anderson, oh, I thought I saw you somewhere. There you are. Ms. Cross, you have 15 minutes. Would you care to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, if I could reserve 3 minutes, please,
right.
Your Honor.
We'll be happy to hear from you when you're ready to go.
May it please the Court. I'm Jessica Cross, Deputy Public Defender for the City of Newport News, on behalf of the appellant, Anthony Bethel. Unless there are any questions about the facts of this case, then we'll move into the argument portion. Your Honors, the first two assignments of error in the petition presented to this court deal with part of the third part of a short three-part statement made by Mr. Bethel as he was pounding on the door of April Evans' home. The record establishes that he was yelling, "Please let me in, baby, baby, let me in, they're trying to kill me." And it is that third and final part of that statement, "they're trying to kill me," that was excluded by the trial court and is the subject.
Let me interrupt you if I can and steer you to something. I want to get to that, but I think there's a more fundamental issue that I'd like you and Mr. Anderson to address. At trial, were you trial counsel or was someone else trial counsel?
I was trial counsel.
Okay, well, at trial you moved to strike the evidence based upon the Commonwealth's failure to prove that Mr. Bethel had the intent to commit one of the requisite misdemeanors. That was really not developed on appeal, and it occurs to me that if you look at the code, it's pretty clear that this particular burglary statute requires that the specific intent be to break and enter with the intent to commit a misdemeanor other than assault and battery or trespass. The underlying offense which the Commonwealth relied upon, which was interference with the property right of an owner, is in the trespass section of the code. Moreover, it seems to me every burglary involves the interference with the property right of the owner. So I guess I'm curious as to the issue was developed, at least preserved below, but has it been really addressed on appeal? And if not, where does that leave us? Because it seems to me if the charge is infirm from the beginning, then we've got a major problem here. So, but would you like to address that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the court really raises two issues, and one thing that was addressed at the trial level was, of course, you could say theoretically that any breaking and entering involves or ultimately results in an interference with the property rights of another, as defined in Code Section 18.2.121. So, I mean, theoretically, you could say that about any breaking and entering, so there would not be the necessary elements of the statute that require one to enter a property with a specific intent to commit that crime. The second issue, Your Honors, that I do think, and this is something that kind of came up later after briefs have been filed, but I do think that the actual
I think my question is really, is this case in a posture we can even address that point?
As far as whether a violation of 18.2.121 is a trespass?
Well, in other words, one of the issues is sufficiency of the evidence.
Yes.
And if the statute requires that the evidence, that the Commonwealth prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the specific intent in this particular case was to commit some offense other than assault and battery or trespass, and the Commonwealth's position was, in essence, that he committed a trespass, then it seems to me the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law, if that's the case. But is that preserved? First of all, is that the case? And secondly, if it is it preserved, or is the case in a posture where we can even consider that point?
Your Honor, I think that it is. I think that what was preserved at trial, in addition to the errors assigned involving the statement, was a sufficiency argument that the Commonwealth had failed to sufficiently prove specifically the intent element of breaking and entering, which I think would encompass...
I agree completely, frankly, that it was preserved at trial. I'm just not sure it's preserved on appeal because it hasn't been really briefed. I mean, it's been sort of... I mean, there's a general, you know, assertion of an insufficiency as a matter of law, but that's pretty much the extent of it, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor, but I think that the error assigned on brief encompasses the broader issue of insufficiency of the evidence with regard to that intent to commit any type of misdemeanor other than trespass or assault and battery. Of course, what the Commonwealth alleged and argued successfully at trial was the intent to commit an offense under 18.2121, and so that is really where the argument, both at trial and appeal, was focused, because that was the argument on which the trial court actually convicted Mr. Bethel. So I think that it is something that is preserved at trial and is preserved on appeal by the more general assignment of error that the evidence was insufficient to prove the intent element beyond reasonable doubt. Just going back, I do want to touch on the errors assigned involving the statements made by Mr. Bethel as he was pounding the door.
Before we leave that assignment, why isn't the evidence sufficient to prove that he intended to either damage the property or interfere with the rights of the owner?
Judge, I think that the reason for that is because the alleged crime that he intended to commit upon entering the property, in this case a violation of 18.2121, that offense in itself has a specific intent element that requires someone to enter or prohibits someone to enter a property for the purpose of interfering or damaging with the property rights of another. And in this case, you could say that, of course, when he entered the property, well, of course he would know that that would some way interfere with the property rights of the owner. The record reflects that he threw himself through the window. Of course, he would know that that would somehow damage the property. But that is different. That knowledge is different from the actual intent element. And really, what the Commonwealth has set in place here is having to prove two separate layers of intent. The intent to commit a misdemeanor upon the breaking and entering.
But why isn't the evidence sufficient that's he did what he did? Why is the evidence sufficient to establish he intended to do that?
Your Honor, there is no evidence that he intended to enter the property or intended to commit a misdemeanor offense when he entered the property.
Well, let me follow up with Judge Petty's question, because I'm not sure you understand the question yet. The point is, when you kick in a front door, go through a window, break the window, that in and of itself is both destruction of property, and if you do it without permission, it's interference with the property right of the owner. But the burglary statutes require something more than that, is one argument. But if that's all that's required, then Judge Petty's point is simply that if you threw yourself through the window, you must have intended to do that, or at least it's a reasonable conclusion that can be drawn that you intended to do that. Now, your motivation, your state of mind, your rationale for doing that might be up for debate, but I think anybody would frankly be forced to agree that a fact finder could accept that you did what you intended to do, that which you did. There's a jury instruction that basically says that's a reasonable inference that a fact finder can draw.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The law surrounding that issue, though, also indicates that absent evidence to the contrary, we can, of course, infer one intended to do what one did.
That presumes that the evidence to the contrary is accepted by the fact finder as credible.
Yes, Your Honor, it does. And I think that going back to the statement that was the issue of assignment of error 1 and 2, that statement, "they're trying to kill me," is evidence to the contrary. It is evidence of his intent. It is evidence of his state of mind at the time that he entered the home. And that ties back to why that statement should have been admitted. It absolutely shows his state of mind. And We can only, you know, we can look for someone's intent by looking at evidence of their state of mind, their acts, their conduct, in this case, their statements, what he was saying as he was trying to gain entry to the home.
But you, as I understand the argument, you want us to consider the excluded evidence in determining what his intent was. And I'm not sure we can do that.
No, Your Honor. I want the court to hold that that excluded evidence should not have been excluded. And had that
evidence... But as far as the sufficiency argument, we have to view it... we have to view the evidence that was actually admitted at trial, not that which was excluded, whether rightly or wrongly.
Of course, Your Honor. But I think that even if you take that excluded evidence out of the picture, what the facts were here is that, you know, there's someone home, there's lights on, there's someone watching TV, and he's banging on the door yelling, "Baby, let me in," and then comes flying through the window, essentially. At which point, and this is Evans, had testified that Mr. Bethel advanced toward her. She, at that point, had a gun, was on the phone with 911, and she shot him. And I think that, you know, even taking that excluded statement out of the picture, that evidence is not sufficient to prove the requisite intent on Mr. Bethel's part when he went into the house. We've, of course, never contested the entering or the breaking and entering part of this case. There's no basis for that, but there is the separate element of intent codified in 18.292 that, of course, must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, just as any other element of the offense.
Let me ask you one last question on the sufficiency. If we agree with you that the evidence of intent is lacking here, that leaves us with the lesser offense of trespass. Do we remand this case back for sentencing on trespass, or do we remand it back for new trial?
Your Honor, I think that if the court has found that the evidence would be insufficient to prove the intent requisite for breaking and entering, I think that the proper remedy would be to remand it back to the trial court for sentencing on trespass if the court finds that the evidence would be sufficient for conviction upon that offense. Judge, if there are no further questions, I think I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. May it please the court. Let me go first to the subject matter that Judge Humphreys went into. First, there was no argument at trial, and there's been none on appeal, that this charge was bad or infirm from the beginning. That was never alleged or never argued. What was argued at trial, but I've gone back in view of Your Honor's questions, I've looked at the briefs of the two sides. What was argued at trial in part was that the burglary conviction under, 18.2-92, was it, whatever the number, that you could say the Commonwealth was arguing that this was interference with the owner's enjoyment of the property, and the argument was, well, you could say that as to any case.
Yeah, why isn't that a good argument? Because it seems to me that any unlawful entry into one's dwelling is to some extent an interference with the property owner's rights to be free from that kind of intrusion.
Several things, Your Honor. First, in sort of a big picture way, if you wanted to challenge the statute on its face as somehow illegitimate for that reason, you could do so. That did not happen here. Second, it's important to consider the facts here versus those that could occur in another case. This occurred at 10:30 at night. The lights, the front lights were on, cars in the driveway. So the clear implication there is that someone is there home enjoying their home life. Contrast that, for example, with a home that's in some isolated area at 2:30 in the afternoon. There's no car there. There's not the slightest indication of anyone there.
Well, let me interrupt you, Mr. Anderson, follow up on Judge Petty again. Let's set the preservation issue aside and speak academically here for a moment. Every break-in involves, it seems to me, at a minimum, a trespass and an interference with the property rights of the owner. I mean, that's inherent in the other elements of the offense, it seems to me. Now, here the Commonwealth had a choice of the entire spectrum of burglary statutes, and you point out some of the aggravating circumstances here quite rightly. This is clearly an occupied dwelling. The defendant, in this case, knew it was occupied, or certainly had reason to know it was occupied, and by virtue of his statements knew it. The point is simply this. The Commonwealth selected Code 18.2-121 as the misdemeanor that was the underlying intent here, which is, says it shall be unlawful for any person to enter the land, dwelling, outhouse, or any other building of another for the purpose of damaging such property or any of the contents thereof, or in any manner interfere with the right of the owner, user, or the occupant thereof to use such property free from interference. That's contained in Article 5 of Title 18.2, which is entitled and styled trespass. So I guess academically, does the statute 18.2-92, which restricts the underlying misdemeanor that the specific intent is related to anything other than assault and battery or trespass, apply to 18.2-121 at all? Let's start there. What's your response?
Well, it'd be nice if I had the code here because it was. It's never been raised in any way, shape, or form. The first thing I would say is that this defendant, in effect, received a major break in terms of the indictment. When you consider the facts here, you could have certainly charged something more serious with a heavier penalty than was alleged.
You can charge anything. The question is, can you convict of it?
Well, my one disadvantage is I don't have handy here Article 5 versus 6. I will simply say there was no challenge in the trial that the fact that 18.2-92 contains certain language meant necessarily that there was some conflict or some variance with
it. It may well be you're correct, and I guess, I don't know that you're necessarily correct because, as I indicated, I think it was arguably preserved below. I'm not sure necessarily under our rules it was preserved on appeal, but nevertheless, it seems to me that when I read the briefs in this case, it struck me immediately that wait a minute, the underlying statute here is a trespass statute, and this the particular code section the Commonwealth elected to indict for doesn't really cover that, or at least arguably doesn't cover that. Now, this may not be the case we decide that point, but it seems to me we at least need to discuss it here.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure if trespass is legally invariably the same as coming in and interfering with the owner's enjoyment of the property free from interference. They are obviously in the same neighborhood, whether or not trespass invariably equates to that, I don't know.
Well, this is probably not the case for us to decide that, but it's the distinction between whether the evidence is insufficient or whether we don't care if it's insufficient because it wasn't preserved. Because then we got to get to the other issue, which is the hearsay issue. Yeah. Which if there's a problem there, then we either remand for a new trial. Or we remand apparently based on the concession I just heard, for resentencing based on trespass.
If I could just make two quick points on this matter, which I hope I can remember at this point in my life, and I may not. Let's see. The counsel today in oral argument says, in the context of what we're talking about now, what was preserved was a sufficiency argument. I agree. That's what was preserved. Nothing more, nothing less. I will also say, if the court is so inclined, I'd be more than happy to file some supplemental brief addressing this particular point, because the Commonwealth certainly has not up to now been apprised that this was an issue it needed to look at or to brief. If the court thinks that's helpful, that would be fine.
Let me move to the other assignment of error, which I think probably is a little more problematic for you. We've discussed the reason why this person broke into the house, the intent what was his intent, what crime did he intend to commit. Now, it seems to me that the statement, "they are trying to kill me," has nothing to do with whether, in fact, there was someone outside trying to kill the defendant. It has all to do with what he thought someone was trying to do to explain why he broke through the door. Why is that hearsay in the first instance? Why do you think that was could conceivably have been offered for the truth of the matter asserted?
Well, I think there's no reason to think otherwise. The defense wanted
what would
to...
The relevance, what would the relevancy be of whether somebody was in fact trying to kill him?
It might explain, if you believe it, you might explain why he was so frantically trying to gain access to this person's home.
But what? Why not just say he thought they were? That in and of itself is enough.
But it wasn't couched in terms of he thought. It was couched in terms of he said they're trying to kill me.
But the point I think is again that the statement was offered to show what his state of mind was. Or at least arguably. Now, of course, that doesn't have to be accepted necessarily. But it's certainly, I just don't understand how it wouldn't be relevant to show what his motivation was for banging on the door and throwing himself through a window.
Well, the starting point was, according to the defense, it was not hearsay. So then you go.
Well, it's not hearsay if it's not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted. By definition, it's not hearsay if that's the case.
I think that this case, in terms of the appellate court resolving it, is actually fairly straightforward. Counsel herself has said, in the course of making the lack of intent sufficiency argument, has said quite rightly, well, she didn't, not her ultimate point, but she pointed to all the things that came in and said that they arrayed against the Commonwealth's evidence was sufficient to show a lack of the requisite intent. And let's just go through what, in fact, came in and was before the trier of fact. You have this person who, Mrs. Evans, the victim, the homeowner, doesn't know from Adam, frantically banging at the door at 10:30 at night. That's obviously a very unusual development. He does so, he says, let me in. And he's banging for about a minute. And he says, "Please, baby, let me in." And then in the court, when she's on the phone, she says, "Is someone chasing you?" And as the defendant concedes on brief, the answer must have been yes, because she then says, "Who was it?" All of that comes in. And the notion that the trier of fact, if it heard the one additional, and the banging went on for at least a minute, according to the victim, and the notion that the trier of fact is going to say, "Well, I'm aware of all this, but now that I know that he said they were trying to kill him, that changes everything," I think that is an untenable argument.
I think you're confusing apples and oranges. It sounds like you're making a harmless error.
I am. I've made a harmless error.
So that presumes there's error in the first place.
Well, yes. I mean,
so are you conceding error in the first place?
No, I'm not. The state of mind, that's my ultimate, I should win for this reason, position. But I submit there was not error. The main argument is state of mind.
The Commonwealth put on evidence which you correctly and properly argue supports the evidence is sufficient to establish that he had a particular state of mind when he broke into this house. The break-in itself is uncontested here. It seems to be all we're arguing about in this case is the evidence concerning the defendant's state of mind when he did so. Now, let me finish. Here, the defense attempted to offer an alternative explanation for what that state of mind was and was prevented from doing so based on a hearsay objection. So I think the place we have to start was the objection well taken? If it was error, then we do a harmless error analysis based on that the application of that analysis.
Let me make a couple of points in response. First, and this is discussed in my brief, the state of mind exception, you cannot properly invoke it if there is evidence indicating that the speaker, in this case the defendant, and presumably typically the defendant...
That presumes that there's an exception to the hearsay rule. We're arguing whether it's hearsay in the first instance.
Well, if
Mr. Anson, let me phrase it in the context of a situation that comes up quite often in trial, and I can't cite the cases, but I know there are many of them on this instance. Police officer is on the witness stand. I got a call to go to 123 Main Street. The caller said there was a burglary in progress. Objection, hearsay. Prosecutors invariably stand up and say, no, it's not hearsay because it's not offered for the truth of whether a burglary was being committed. It's only being offered to show why the police officer drove to 123 Main Street. To me, I don't see any distinction here. This is being offered to prove why he broke into the house, not whether somebody was trying to kill him or not.
But the problem, and by the way, I can be glad somewhere down the line to get into that line of cases, because about 82 years ago, I argued one of my first cases in the Supreme Court of Virginia, Upchurch v. Commonwealth, and got into that precise point. And all I can tell you is, to me, it was never hearsay because it was not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, but to show the impact on the listener. All I can say is from researching the case law was by no means uniform as to whether it was hearsay or not. But as to this, the defendant's argument conveniently ignores what happens when he went in. When he went in, he said, oh, thank God you've let me in. Please call the police. My life's at risk. Or give me the phone so I can make a call. Does he do any of those things? No. He runs towards her. He comes within about 5 feet. She says she's terrified. And in an act of self-defense, and there's no assertion that her action was not a proper exercise of self-defense, she shoots him twice. His actions within the home totally belie his alleged state of mind outside. And that's why these cases I've cited at pages 8 and 9 are so important.
That's like arguing that you're only not paranoid if people really are out to get you. There's a lot of evidence here to at least suggest that we have someone that wasn't in a really a correct state of mind, if you will. I mean,
that was mostly brought out at sentencing, so of course that does the defendant no good now.
I mean, the evidence as to why he broke into the house obviously indicates that he was delusional in some respect.
The defendant never argued that in the guilt phase.
Well, I'm not talking about from a guilt or innocence standpoint. I'm talking about intent.
The defendant never argued at trial. He's never argued an appeal. These actions are so bizarre. They're so beyond the pale. They show that he couldn't have had the requisite criminal intent. That's never been argued. Again,
he didn't get to argue that because the statement was excluded.
Well, according to the defense attorney's argument now, all this other stuff came in. In fact, that was heavily played up in the motion to strike. The notion that the court was aware, as the trier of fact was aware, of all these other matters, but somehow this one snippet that didn't come in just tore the case. I submit that's an untenable proposition.
But before you finish, let me conclude with one question we need to ask. What do we do on a sufficiency argument if we agree with the appellant? Do we reverse and remand for new trial or reverse and remand for sentencing?
To be honest with you, my impression is the cases don't seem to be entirely in sync, and I would concur with counsel that it would just be resentencing. But again, I would urge the court on the state of mind exception in considering his actions once he got in vis-a-vis those before he entered, to look at pages 8 and 9, because the trier of fact, after all, this is all in the context of a factual finding of intent. And like any other finding of intent on appeal, it's enforceable unless it's plainly wrong or lacking fair support in the record. And I've cited Swanson. This is at page 8. State of mind exception didn't authorize admission of the evidence because it, quote, didn't actually concern the appellant's state of mind, because the trier of fact could reasonably have concluded that, quote, this supposed statement by appellant was simply further evidence of appellant's attempt to cover up his crime. The Smith case, capital murder case, at page 8, and I've clearly botched one sentence.
Wrap it up, Mr. Anderson.
Okay. I submit under Smith, Swanson, and Hodges at page 8 of my brief that his actions within the home were so at odds with his statements before he got in as to, at the very least, support the trier facts of discretionary ruling excluding this one sentence.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Crossett?
Ms. Crossett, I'd like you to address, if you would, Mr. Anderson's argument that even if it was error to exclude the statement, someone's trying to kill me, that that error would be harmless in light of all the other evidence that came in that he was breaking in, fleeing from somebody, as opposed to breaking in for some illegal purpose.
Yes, Your Honor. I planned to do just that. When you're looking at whether something is harmless error, particularly non-constitutional harmless error, the question is whether it can be said from the record that the parties had a fair trial and substantial justice has been reached. One of the cases cited by the Commonwealth, Angel v. Commonwealth, states that you know, it's a question of whether the error was so insignificant and the other evidence of guilt so overwhelming that we can say the error did not have a substantial effect on the verdict. I don't think that that is the case here. In excluding the statement, "They're trying to kill me," the court completely shut down and excluded a reasonable hypothesis of innocence, an alternative theory as to why Bethel was entering the home. And because of that exclusion, it put a damper on the defenses that Mr. Bethel could have raised on his own behalf. You cannot look at that and say that, you know, he had a fair trial or that error was so insignificant.
It seems to be a harmless error analysis here would require that that the evidence be so overwhelming that the trial court's failure to admit this particular evidence would have been basically mere surplusage, because there theoretically should be other evidence of his state of his version of what his state of mind was that the trial court could have considered and rejected. How do you deal with that?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think that this is a case where the other evidence was so overwhelming to show his intent, the requisite intent upon entering that home. The Commonwealth points out, you know, the way that he acted once in the home. All the record shows is that he advanced in the direction of Mrs. Evans and she shot him. After that, she asked him if someone was chasing him. She asked who was chasing him. She asked his name and date of birth when she was on the phone.
Did the answers to those questions come into evidence?
They did not, Your Honor. So there are other things that happen once inside the home that I think still raise a question, or at least a reasonable doubt, as to what his intent was. It's not as if he came into the home and immediately, you know, pulled out a gun himself or went to attack her or went to commit any type of misdemeanor offense. I think that his actions once in the home still raise a doubt as to what his intent was. I'd like to just briefly distinguish a few of the cases that the Commonwealth brought up a few minutes ago. The case of Swanson specifically, I think, is entirely distinguishable, because one of the problems in that case, and this deals with state of mind, and I'm going back to the statement wasn't hearsay to begin with, so I don't think we get to that point. But in that case, one of the big problems for the appellant was that at trial the statements had not been proffered. That's distinguishable here, and I see that my time is up.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
As is our tradition, we will come down and greet counsel and then take up the matter.